This is a Defocus Media production.
Hey, everybody. I'm your four-eyed professor, Chris Levens, and I'm super excited to talk to you today. Our roll call is for new and experienced ODs, optometry students, and even those just interested in this profession. We'll cover a number of topics together, and I'll help you see them through a professor's eyes. Please take your seats. School's in session.
And now a word from our sponsors. Did you know that 77% of eyeglass wearers wipe their lenses with t-shirts, tissues, or towels? Or that 1 in 3 people actually admit to accidentally dropping their glasses at least once a week? No one in the eye care industry needs to be told that this will lead to scratches on lenses and unhappy patients. So it's hardly surprising that 93% of wearers consider scratch resistance an important characteristic when choosing lenses. The latest Crizal lens innovation is here to help, and it's more durable than ever before. New Crizal Rock lenses are 3 times more scratch resistant than entry-level Crizal products and 2 times easier to clean than main competitors after extensive smudging. For more information about how you can bring this incredible new technology to your practice, go to EssilorPro.com/Crizal-Rock or contact your Essilor account executive for more details.
Welcome to the next episode in which we are continuing down the road of optometric legal issues and some malpractice cases. And last episode, we did cover the 4 hoops of malpractice that the plaintiff patient and plaintiff attorney side has to go through in order to get a case even to fruition. So we're going to continue on that road and talk about some other areas of liability for us, some other areas of concern, and tie up a few of the loose ends once a case actually gets to fruition. So first off, in the unfortunate event that you or I or a colleague finds themselves in a lawsuit and unfortunately they don't win. So what happens then? Well, damages are set. And the most common damages that are decided for the plaintiff side are compensatory damages. So whereas there is no rule book for identifying the standard of care in medical practice or eye care that we talked about last episode, there actually are some rule books of a sort when it comes to compensatory damages. And so what I mean by that is there are ways to identify based on the age of the patient and what they've suffered some type of financial positioning to put them at least monetarily in a position that they would be in had they not had the injury. So here's where it really comes down to in our realm, what is vision worth? What is blurry vision worth that's permanent, let's say? What is the right eye worth? What is bilateral blindness worth? And obviously the more severe and the more permanent, well, the more value is put on them. Again, to put the plaintiff financially, the patient plaintiff in a position financially that they would be have been in had they not had the injury. And these amounts can be significant. So as practitioners, we all carry medical malpractice insurance. It is wise to take a look at those documents in detail to assure that you feel good as it can be anyway, about your standing and your coverage. So a common malpractice insurance plan may be $1 million per incident with a $3 million aggregate, or a $3 million per incident coverage with a $5 million aggregate. And what those values mean, let's take the latter. The latter means in a calendar year of coverage, if that's my plan, I would be covered per lawsuit case up to $3 million per loss. The aggregate piece comes in is that if I have a horrible year and get sued and lose multiple cases in the same 12-month period, well, a 3-5 plan would mean that cumulatively I could lose up to $5 million and be covered. The problem comes in that probably the reason why most of, if not all of us, got into this profession is that value of eyesight is significant. And when it is gone and when folks lose it permanently, well, the numbers can get high. Now, I will say, knock on wood, historically, optometric malpractice does not cost a lot of money yearly. And that's not just because we're super nice, talented people. It's because the insurance agents look at creating the policy around history. And historically, what has been lost in optometry and for what amount? And there really has not been a lot of cases that have faced us. And so that's why still, for the most part, we are covered at a relatively low level compared to other professionals. Well, there's a whole other category of damages that's much less common, much more rare, and those are called punitive damages. And those are additional damages that a judge or jury can levy on the defendant really to set an example for others. That's why they're so rare. Somebody really has to go the extreme to really want to have an example set of them that others will not do the same thing should they be presented with a very similar circumstance. Well, before that even happens, if you're in a lawsuit, what is your defense? Or what might be some options for you? Well, here are a few. The first would be lack of casual relation. So if you recall, in our four hoops discussion, the plaintiff patient had to have suffered something. And that has to be linked through proximate cause to what the provider did or did not do. Well, lack of causal relation implies that the proximate cause connect the dots is faulty. That yes, it is plausible that the provider failed to do something, but that failure did not lead to the patient's ultimate injury. So the debate would all be about proximate cause. Well, we all see patients, and some of you may be listening, may soon see patients. And patients and human beings sometimes do odd things. So another defense may be an abnormal use of a product, carrying with it some assumption of risk. So honestly, a prime example would be a contact lens wearer who overuses and abuses their contact lenses, maybe having a daily disposable contact lens and wears it maybe continuously for months at a time. That's happened. Or attempts to clean it and use it for months at a time. So that would be an abnormal use of the product, not recommended or advised by the prescriber, and there would be some assumption of risk that the patient is taking on by carrying out that way. So that then leads to your state legalese and the state in which you practice, because there are two different camps. There is contributory negligence and comparative negligence, which differ slightly. And what those imply is that if the plaintiff patient acts in such a way that they assume some of the risk by abusing something or using a product abnormally, that they are at fault for, at least in part, for the injury that they suffered. Now, the provider may be in part at fault as well, but some of it's on the patient and maybe some of it's on the provider. And depending on the state, it can be an all or nothing decision where 100% of the fault is on the patient and they receive no money in damages, 100% conversely on the provider, in which they have to pay out 100% of the damages, or in some states, it can actually be a split where the patient can be 25% responsible, 50% responsible, et cetera. And there is some divvying up then and a reduction of the damages because the patient was partly at fault. Informed consent is a topic that we should spend a little bit of time on because it happens to be something that we deal with on every patient that we see. It's important to remember that a patient has an inviolable right to their own body and what happens to it. In the course of our examination, one of the common issues that has arisen legally was with regards to a dilated fundus examination, that we may have failed to educate the patient as to what effect this short-term diagnostic drug would have, and the patient may go on to have a problem. There was actually a case involving optometry that's a bit bizarre, in which a long-standing diabetic patient had repeated and yearly eye exams with that, in which they were dilated. And through their medical records, routinely the patient was advised about the side effects, that they would have a difficulty reading for a few hours and may have some sensitivity to light. Well, lo and behold, on one visit, the patient was dilated, and on their way home, they had a slip and fall accident and proceeded to initiate a lawsuit. And as it turned out, just through sheer bad luck, that on that particular visit, the patient's chart did not specifically say that some side effects of this DFE were explained to the patient. And that case did not go to court, but it was settled out of court for a substantial amount of money, surprisingly, because the patient ought to have known better since this was not new to them. But nevertheless, it's just a reminder to have something, especially in today's world, on your electronic health records, where it may be just a click of a button or an X in a box, just to say, yes, the patient was educated on this. Long-term use of topical steroids has been a common target in an area in eye litigation. There was a case in which I was involved in which the provider's electronic health record pharmaceutical screen, for some reason, auto-populated the number of refills. And a patient was prescribed a strong topical steroid, and the auto-populated refill count was, for some reason, set at 9. So though the patient shouldn't have gone for 8 more refills, and the pharmacy probably should not have dispensed 8 more refills, that did transpire, and the patient went on to suffer some issues subsequent to that long-term use. So proper documentation, proper disclosure of treatments that we're proposing for the patient, proper disclosure of any risks to any in-office procedures or treatments, failure to disclose alternatives to treatment, as well as abnormalities, are all under this heading of informed consent in areas that it's wise to think about. Any of these things can initiate litigation, which is just a simple way of saying a lawsuit in which a plaintiff brings about a civil action toward a defendant who's incurred some type of loss and is demanding a legal or equitable, i.e. financial, remedy. Now, there's a whole set of categories that really are less common, much less common than malpractice and negligence, but things that we should at least touch on. There's a whole category that we're really not going to spend time on whatsoever, and those are criminal cases. But because fraud and criminal cases are categorically in the same section of law, there's other things like sex offenses and moral acts, prior convictions. But fraud is something that does touch on us a little bit, and so we will correspondingly touch on that as well. So what about the intentional offenses? By the very word of intentional, unlike negligence that refers to a standard of care, the intentional torts look to intent. So a great example would be defamation. Defamation being written or oral communication that's made by one person to another person about a third party. And this injures the reputation of the third party. In this scenario, the plaintiff must show that the communication was, and we'll loosely use the word, published. And published meaning that the third person's identity could be identified, that the commentary made, written or oral, is reasonably understood to be negative and caused some form of injury. If this comes to fruition, there's really not a whole lot of defenses. One may say, well, I was telling the truth. That is a defense, but it has to be morally appropriate, and you just did not say something completely in a derogatory fashion about someone and claim it to be true. So it's a tricky one, but that still is a defense. If you are a judge, if you're a lawyer, if you're a witness on the stand, well, you are responsible to tell the truth regardless of what you're saying, and that's called absolute privilege. But presumably, we're not talking about those categories. The third defense is one that I'll hit a little bit on, and that's mitigation of damages. So this is probably the one, if you find yourself in any case that involves an issue like defamation, mitigation or a retraction of your statements or a simple apology honestly goes a long way, not just interpersonally, but also legally. Another category in this area is disclosure of confidential information. And it's something that in recent years, a lot of us are aware of with regards to privacy. But physicians have a duty not to disclose information of a confidential nature that's revealed by patients in the course of their examination. And most importantly, they have to get it right. So the craziest case that I've ever read about with regards to disclosure of confidential, and in this case, misinformation, which also ties back to the absence of mitigation of damages, is a case called Vigil versus Rice. So in this case, it was not in eye care. This was a young teenage girl, high school student, who was seeing her pediatrician. And she went because she was ill, and as it turned out, she had mononucleosis. And so she was going to have to be away from school for some period of time. Let's just say, I don't know, a month or two or three. Well, the letter went to the school from the physician's office to justify the need for the absence. But instead of saying mononucleosis, the physician's office said that she was pregnant. And you better believe that in the small town that the school was in, that word started to spread, gets back to the patient and her family, and she's like, okay, time out. I've got mononucleosis. I am not pregnant. Calls the school, and then, of course, calls the doctor's office to say, hey, can you retract this? Again, mitigate the damage of my reputation, as well as do not disclose not just personal information, but misinformation. And surprisingly, the practice ignored the calls and never retracted anything. So they failed to mitigate the damages. And in this case, if you remember, we talked about punitive damages being rare. In this case, not only did the judge side for the plaintiff for damage to one's reputation, he initiated punitive damages on top of that, because it is just completely ridiculous for a doctor's office not to retract their obvious error. The next category, and I promised I was going to get to this one, is fraud. Fraud's a big word, and it sounds bad, but if we're not careful, we can actually practice in a way and talk to our patients in such a way that could be construed as fraudulent. This is something easy to rectify, but something to be cognizant of, so we're careful in the words that we're choosing. So, for example, if we as a patient's provider assure the patient that there is no risk, and yet there is risk, albeit small, albeit rare, that's fraud. So when we're talking to our patients, let's say, hypothetically, they're going for a consultation to get their cataracts extracted. And we're talking positive, as most of our patients tolerate that procedure very well and see significantly better post-cataract extraction. Sometimes, in rare cases, it doesn't go so well. So if we tell Miss Jones, Miss Jones, 100%, you're going to be great after this. Your vision is going to be fantastic. It's a very simple procedure. You're going to be in and out, awake, heal well, and love your vision. Well, if we didn't say there is actually some risk, we could have been fraudulent. If we misrepresent results, if we test a patient or scan a patient or image a patient and misrepresent our interpretation of the results to calm them perhaps, that's also fraudulent. And of course, there's much more egregious things. If we recommend treatment to a patient without reasonable medical justification, well, that's way in the deep end of fraud. But there are some subtleties, as you can see, in which we can, in all good attempts to alleviate our patient's concern and try to relax them and calm them, well, it can really get us into some murky areas. So pay attention to that in terms of how you're communicating with your patient. The doctor-patient relationship is a tricky one. It's one that satisfies our career and that we take care of a lot of people successfully, but it's a tricky one when things go awry. And there are some questions that are oftentimes very difficult to answer and initiate some form of debate. For example, the doctor-patient relationship, well, when does it begin? Does it begin at the point in which a patient calls our office to set up an appointment and maybe our appointment clerk starts to ask, well, why are you coming in? And maybe it sounds like that's the initiation of a medical history, at least a chief complaint. And if that patient does not come in a timely fashion, are we potentially responsible? Maybe. And so I'm not saying yes or no, I'm just saying maybe. And so the doctor-patient relationship is tricky. I already mentioned, but do not forget, the patient has an inviolable right to their own body. So that means they have the right to accept proper treatment or reject proper treatment. And so this is a scenario where, again, looking at your state statute and what's common practice in your area and region, there may be times in which you have to do something such as fire your patient with proper documentation. If you have a patient that's refusing treatment over and over or non-attentive to their follow-up encounters, and you foresee the situation going awry for them, you have a right to discontinue your care of that patient through a letter, ideally sent to them via certified mail that you get a receipt back that it was sent that you can then include in your chart. There is a way to do that because you may not want to be the last provider that patient has seen. Because once under care and treatment of a patient, remember, we have a legal duty to conform to the standard of care that's decided, as we talked about, through expert witness, which is the topic that we'll talk about later, in the four hoops of malpractice that we discussed last time. Well, what happens if you're gone? That kind of puts a stopgap, ideally, in this relationship, in that I would have, hopefully, a competent replacement to see patients in our absence. So the relationship still continues. It just may have a temporary person in the mix if we happen to be out. So a few tidbits here. You cannot leave your office and assume it's the patient's responsibility to take on their own issues independent or see somebody else automatically. Ideally, there's clear instructions with your staff on your voicemail, on your website that communicate a temporary absence that then can guide your staff or the patient to see alternative care should they get in a bind and need some attention. So the topics that we talked about today are much less common, but still some things that at least put in the back burner of your memory banks so that you may slightly alter your practices just to protect yourself as much as possible in these areas. The next episode, which we're going to get to, is one of all of our favorite topics, which is patient medical records and proper record keeping, and challenge for all of us, quite frankly. So thank you for attending today and be on the lookout for the next episode on medical records.
Class is ended for today and we have no exams or grades approaching. Please email me at foureyedprofessor@gmail.com if there are topics that you would like to hear and see through a professor's eyes.